Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast in which, for this episode at least, I'm going to nursemaid Andrew into Star Trek. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
So this is Film Strips, the podcast that each and every episode takes a look at a movie, but whatever film is under discussion has to somehow connect back to the film that we discussed the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last week?
Well, last week... What were we looking at last week, David? I've been trying to survive my pre-holiday shopping.
We were taking a look at Punch Drunk Love.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
And we're on a deferred taping schedule, and sometimes I can't remember which temporality my head needs to be in. So yes, we looked at Paul Thomas Anderson's eccentric, bawling and brawling in equal measure, atypical love story, Punch Drunk Love, from 2002.
Yes.
And from there, through a very curious link, we followed Robert... Oh, man. What was his name? Robert...
Is it Ellsworth or Elswit?
Robert Elswit. Yeah. That's the one. And this, kids, is why you do your research. Robert Elswit, who did cinematography on Punch Drunk Love, apparently one of his earliest jobs was working as a camera operator on the film we're looking at this week, which is the 1979 bold journey into the unknown, Star Trek, the motion picture. Not the movie, the motion picture, directed by Robert Wise, and starring, well, the usual suspects, William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, Walter Koenig, Nichelle Nichols, George Takei, and of course, as you've noted, Stephen Scumbag Collins.
Yeah, Stephen Collins, the first of two future Seventh Heaven stars to be in Star Trek movies, but the only one that we can feel, you know, warm and inside for absolutely recognizing that we hate him.
Yes, the first one of the two to appear before a judge.
In order to get this, I'm sure our listeners are more than likely are familiar with Star Trek, or at the very least, they know the title. They can probably name some of the iconography or bits and pieces of it. But, Andrew, I'm going to turn this over to you first. What is your relationship with Star Trek, such as it is?
Well, as we've talked about in previous episodes, looking more concretely at genres, and especially adaptations, like, there are some properties where they are so ubiquitous in culture and so iconic that even without having seen any of it, you pretty much have a functional understanding. And I think we can agree Star Trek is one of those properties. You know, it's not that I've never seen it. I've actually met Patrick Stewart and William Shatner live and in person. But I will freely say I was never a Trekkie and never had that kind of intense fandom. So I've seen, you know, the memorable episodes of the original series. I've seen the memorable episodes of The Next Generation. I've seen a couple of the movies, and that's about it. But, I mean, I know The Enterprise. I know Prime Directives. I know Dilithium Crystals. And the rest I just kind of pieced together in an ad hoc manner.
Yes. My relationship's a little probably more intense than yours. While I certainly imagine myself to be more level-headed than some Star Trek fans out there, Star Trek is probably one of my first major geek fandoms to have ever belonged to. Certainly when I was growing up, it was right at the heyday of Trek where basically Shatner and company were either just retiring from the franchise or had just retired, and, you know, Next Gen was on the air, Deep Space Nine was not that far off from happening. I mean, it was a glory day to kind of grow up with that. And, yeah, while many of my fellow kids that I grew up with were Star Wars fans, for me, Trek was always where it's at, and remains to be the case today when it comes to the classic Wars versus Trek debate.
It seems like the Beatles versus the Stones only shunted into sci-fi. And I mean, I'll probably say that I'm more familiar with Star Wars. And I think maybe that could also inform my reaction to this film. Because it seems Star Wars, as we've talked about, is very, very self-consciously a throwback to Westerns, to the work of Akira Kurosawa, and to old 1930s and 40s film serials. Whereas it seems Star Trek is much more concept-driven, and I think as a property is much more interested in world-building, sometimes even at the cost of action and excitement. And, like, especially with the rebooted franchise from J.J. Abrams, it's very easy to sort of walk into the classic Star Trek films expecting something that's more tonally proximate to what Abrams is doing. And I think the first thing anybody who's encountering Star Trek the motion picture for the first time needs to realize, this is not that kind of movie. This is not an action film in space. And, you know, it's weird because, like, where we're at with culture, Star Trek is kind of evolved beyond that into its modern incarnation. And what we see here in this film is something that's decidedly aiming for a different target.
Well, it's the thing. The motion picture, as we'll get into in depth in a few moments, it is a very key linchpin in the Star Trek canon. It's not necessarily held as being the best of the original films, but it's certainly, its influence, both positive and negative, is unmistakable, and it also serves as kind of a breaking point when you get into the franchise, both in terms of the power plays behind the scenes of it, and the directions it would end up going. But I guess in order to dial it back a bit, and give some of our listeners a bit more context on Star Trek, for those who...
Before there's a motion picture, how do we justify there being a motion picture?
Well, okay, so for those who have no concept as to what Star Trek is in the first place, in 1966, and this is the heavily abbreviated version of this, I might add, NBC launches a little show called Star Trek, created by Gene Roddenberry, which follows the five-year mission of the USS Enterprise, a spaceship in the 23rd century, which, as you might gather, is seeking out and exploring the unknown on behalf of Starfleet, basically the Navy in space, except mostly made up of scientists, who represent the Federation, basically a series of aligned worlds all coming together, looking to peacefully coexist and learn from one another. And basically, Star Trek at the time, I mean, the old go-by was that it was wagon train to the stars, in the sense that, yeah, it's basically about going out on the frontier, finding out what's out there, and pretty much reporting back and, in theory, sort of, expanding one's knowledge. And it was part
Now, if I'm not mistaken, though, aren't they supposed to boldly go somewhere as well?
Yes, as the original series framed it, where no man has gone before, which was eventually adjusted by 1987's Star Trek Next Generation to where no one has gone before. But the point of the matter is, when it comes to Star Trek, yes, the series was starred William Shatner, DeForest Kelly, and Leonard Nimoy as the characters of Kirk, McCoy, and Spock, respectively. Basically, as has typically been boiled down to, the head, the passion, the heart, and the brain.
The bones.
Yes. So basically, yeah, the idea that of these trifecta of the main characters, although there are others that would become part of the cast as well, and we'll get to them in a bit. The main series focused on Captain Kirk, is played by Shatner, the sort of rugged young captain of this vessel, who is a bit of a ladies' man. He's a bit headstrong, but he's also passionate and firmly believes in his sense of duty. There was Bones McCoy, his loyal doctor and friend, who was compassionate, although he definitely hid that behind a rather gruff exterior.
And yes, then, he damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor fame.
Exactly. And then there was Lieutenant Commander Spock, the science officer of the ship and Kirk's second in command, who is half human and half Vulcan. And for those who don't know what Vulcans are, basically think humans with pointier ears and a dedication to the concept of logic as framing basically how one chooses to live their life. Almost pure dedication to, following things to their logical conclusions and going wherever it takes you. Now, in the case of Spock, of course, the old conflict was the fact that, yes, he's half human, half Vulcan, so there was always that conflict between the emotions he keeps very much firmly in control and the way he chooses to live his life. And typically each week they would confront some sort of weird sci-fi mystery or situation, and it would become usually through examining these issues more or less, to generalize for a second, you know, from the, you know, seeing it from these three different perspectives, with Kirk but usually having to sort of balance out the viewpoints of Spock and McCoy to arrive at a reasonable conclusion that would satisfy everyone. And
now, if I'm not mistaken, Dave, though, as I understand it, I haven't seen, like, the full run of the original series, but I do know that in sort of the paratext around Star Trek, that a lot has been made of the fact that Star Trek presents a sort of kind of a utopian polyculturalist view of the world, and that in exploring some of the thematics through the show, that there, I don't know, maybe you can speak to this a bit more, but as I understand, like, the setups are not simply space monster of the week as much as they're using the trappings of sci-fi to be a sort of commentary on present day issues.
Yeah, typically.
Is that fair?
That is fair. I mean, certainly, I mean, as with any show, it had covered a wide spectrum of things, and there are great episodes of Star Trek, and there are some not so great episodes of Star Trek. And the utopic vision and, you know, sort of wondrous, you know, utopia that everybody exists tends to get overblown from time to time, and we'll come back to that issue in a few moments. But yeah, I mean, certainly you would have allegorical episodes in which characters are dealing with very thinly veiled versions of the racial conflicts going on in America in the 1960s. You would have Cold War allegories going on, particularly whenever the concept of the Federation meeting up with the Klingons. Basically, at the time, or as originally presented, more or less intended to be the equivalent of the Russians. By the time you get to the 1980s, however, as the Cold War is sort of gradually coming to a close, that perspective
starting to warm.
Yeah, it's basically, there's a shift in terms of how the Klingons function allegorically within the concept of the series. So you have those things, but then you would also get, you know, episodes that were more, not necessarily allegorical, but certainly dealing with concepts and hard sci-fi issues and moral and ethical questions. And sometimes you get episodes where apparently there's a planet that entirely consists of 1930s gangsters.
I do remember that.
Piece of the action, man. One of the gloriously bonkers episodes of that show.
So I guess all that to say is that Star Trek as a series, it sounds like something that from the get-go, it's more cerebral in its focus than a lot of other sort of popularly consumed sci-fi, certainly of that time and even now. But there's also the way that this universe was laid out and sort of foreseen by Gene Roddenberry, not to mention some pretty, like, a very impressive rotating writer's room, pretty much the who's who of sci-fi and pulp. And, I mean, we also got that wonderful Harlan Ellison anecdote.
Yeah.
But it seems like it's a universe that's adaptive. Right, in the sense that I don't know if, let's say, Game of Thrones, as a contemporary example, I don't know if that's a universe that can sort of sustain, like, being a lens on different social issues or changing tastes. Like, something like Game of Thrones, I feel like, is always going to be what it is. Whereas Star Trek, I mean, the fact that we're still talking about 50 years later, the fact that it has existed in many different incarnations across many different forms of media, that there's a certain openness of it that allows it to remain relevant and sort of reorganize itself to remain relevant.
Well, it's the interesting thing, because I think so much of what's happened in Star Trek in terms of popular perception and popular culture always needs to be taken with a bit of grain of salt. Because when you watch the original show, like I said, you're right, many episodes aim to be cerebral or deal with some heady issues, but it was always a very pulpy show in its presentation. I mean, this was a primetime NBC program there. And yeah, I mean, there is episodes where, many of episodes, Kirk will get into a fist fight. There will be spaceship battles. The idea of it being this super heady show, I think, is something that really comes a bit later. And what ends up happening, but to sort of condense this down quickly for folks, Star Trek ends up running for 3 seasons and wasn't, by the definitions of the time, a hit when it originally aired. In fact, it doesn't even make the number of episodes to hit syndication, but the choice is made to syndicate it anyway. And what ends up happening is, as the ratings system, as I understand it, shifts in the early 1970s from what the sort of overwhelming, what is the strict numbers, how many people are watching, to a more demographic-based version of the ratings, suddenly there is an awareness that, oh, the people watching Star Trek were the ones that are sort of what would become considered the key demographic, those with money to spare and, you know, could be targeted to towards advertisers. And over the course of the next, you know, 7 to 8 years, Star Trek in syndication becomes huge, becoming probably even bigger than it was at the time it was airing. And from that point forward, there ends up being considerations of, well, how do we bring Star Trek back? And this takes on initially the form of, we're going to do a movie, which you would think would lead directly into our conversation about the film, but that's not quite the way it goes, is it, Andrew?
Yeah, fans of the show will know that there's no such thing as a simple production history.
Yes, so the short version is, the initial concepts towards developing a feature film eventually evolve into a resurrected version of the TV series to be called Star Trek Phase 2. And this was supposed to be the show that would anchor a brand new fourth network at the time, basically one owned and run by Paramount Studios. And what ends up happening is Gene Roddenberry is lured back towards running this again. And at this point in time, he starts gathering together a writer's room, reaching out to cast, and succeeds in basically assembling the majority of them, save for one major holdout, which is Leonard Nimoy, somebody who was not exactly comfortable with having almost been typecast and his links to Spock, at least at that point in time in his career. He would mellow out considerably later on that, but it was a big issue. So the new show was going to be a blend between old cast and some new cast, and would pick up, yes, with the continuing voyages of the Starship Enterprise years down the line. And a funny thing happens on the way to this, however, and that is a little thing called Star Wars, released in 1977. And after Star Wars, a little film called Close Encounters of the Third Kind in 1978, which suddenly proved that science fiction on the big screen can make a ton of money for the studios willing to take a gamble on this. And
not to say that Star Wars, and certainly not Close Encounters, are derivative of Star Trek, but I think part of what it sort of prepared the audiences to be so receptive to these properties, in large part, I think, can be sort of that influence and that fandom in sci-fi and the fantastical and space narratives. I think some of that enthusiasm is directly informed by Star Trek, especially in syndication. So it ends up creating this weird effect where it's not as clear-cut as Star Trek led to Star Wars, and now Star Wars is the influence on the Star Trek film. But I think there's definitely a tension in some of the shots and some of the ways that the motion picture presents itself that feel very much like it's an informed response to the success of those two films.
Well, what ends up happening here from the production standpoint is basically what was going to be the pilot episode of this new Star Trek show ends up pretty much evolving into what would become the motion picture. From a story by Alan Dean Foster, a noted science fiction author, and as has scientifically been proven, writer of about 43% of the novelizations you read as a child, is adapted by Harold Livingston into a screenplay. Gene Roddenberry, for the one and only time in the feature films, is in charge of the production, and that's something very key to keep in mind. And eventually, a major director in the form of Robert Wise, he who gave us The Day the Earth Stood Still, The Sound of Music, and who began his career as an editor, including editing a little film called Citizen Kane, is put in charge of
this. Yeah, you might have heard of that one.
Yeah, of this film.
It's the Shakes the Clown of conflicted biographical dramas.
but of course. But yes, so they somehow convince Leonard Nimoy to finally come back in on this film. And Bob's your uncle, everything's off and running, and it should all go smoothly, right? Sort of. I guess is the short way to get into it. The production was somewhat troubled, because technically there were these... While the film had the first two acts down pretty cold, the third act of this film was a constantly evolving piece of work that they never quite had nailed down till late in the production.
Likewise, and that's a very real pressure when you're adapting media, especially going from television, which has... It has the benefit of duration. It has the benefit of sort of aggregating its own canon over time. So by the time you get to like season 7, they don't have to explain things to new viewers. And I mean, as we were saying before we started rolling here, like even now, there's talk about making a Deadwood movie. There's talk about making a Breaking Bad film. And sort of the question that emerges from all of it is, when you have all like this rich material to work with, and how do you distill that into 2 and 2.5 hours to make one singular film intended to appeal to both the existing audience and the new one? And like with a show that can be as polymorphous as Star Trek is, I mean, I can understand why they were sort of stumped, where it's like, okay, but How do we summarize the spirit of our show in a new form?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I would say that there are basically three forms of adaptation when it comes to bringing television to film. There's your, let's just take episodes of a show, edit it together, and call it a movie, which we get with things like Battlestar Galactica, for those who have seen the quote-unquote feature film version of that. You have,
or David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
That one's a little bit different, but yes, technically true. Then there's also the choice of, well, it's a brand new production that's adapting the show and basically, you know, is meant to stand apart from it. So I think this is something that most of us are familiar with when it comes to things such as, you know, the Dark Shadows movie of recent years, or any remake of a classic TV series that came out, disappointed everyone, and then bombed.
Or, you mean all of them?
Well, almost. And then you get things which are actually continuations and extensions of the show, which Star Trek fits into this category. And the thing that's interesting is that when it comes to distilling down with the show, I think this is one of the key points when it comes to Star Trek, because it's one of these things where I think a lot of people have a very locked-in perception of what it can and cannot be, and any attempts to, despite the fact that the original show was as wild and crazy as it could be, there's frequently been efforts to sort of rein it in and make it something very specific. And I think much of this has to do with Gene Roddenberry. Because the thing about Roddenberry is, by the time you get to this film, Roddenberry, even though a lot... I don't know if it was quite in place by this point, because certainly I wasn't alive by this time, but I think by the time, especially you get to the 80s and Next Gen begins, there's what ends up being the cult of Roddenberry, as I like to refer it to, where he is an almost messianic type figure, where his word is God's word, and he had this grand utopic vision of all things, you know, and what Star Trek is, and heaven forbid we violate that word. And I think Roddenberry, number one, if you do any research into his personal life and behavior, trust me, he isn't a messianic figure, and boy, oh boy, the words hypocrite will come up a lot. There's a reason he has credit on the Star Trek theme from Alexander Courage, even though he had nothing to do with that. But putting that aside, the thing about Roddenberry is I think he started to buy into his own hype. And one of the things with this Star Trek The Motion Picture is this is the point where you start to see Star Trek moving from its, you know, sort of pulpy, you know, primetime network show that is much smarter than that was much smarter than I think a lot of television at the time was, to suddenly being something more self-consciously serious. And
yeah, and it feels from frame one, they, like, we look back at Star Trek and sort of revel in the campiness of it. Or, you know, there's a certain pleasure in episodes where, yes, everyone's a 1930s gangster. None of that is here. Like, it feels like they're very consciously trying to make a, like, what we would call now a grounded take on the Star Trek universe. It's very, very solemn, very dignified, very po-faced. But in doing that, though, I mean, you risk running afoul of a certain sect of the fans that really do appreciate the more fringier elements of Star Trek. And therein lies the problem again of how do you make a film like this and please everybody?
And this is the thing, I think, with Star Trek films, because I think there's sort of two sides to what you're saying, because number one, you can't please anybody. And I think if one thing's gone on with Star Trek over the years, it doesn't matter whether it's the J.J. Abrams movies, it doesn't matter whether it's the Rick Berman-produced next-gen movies of the late 90s and early 2000s, and it certainly doesn't matter if it's the sequels to this film that were produced under a completely different group of people, pretty much. The Star Trek, you know, there's always fans who will nitpick and disagree with one another about what it is. Even Star Trek Discovery, which, you know, is probably one of the best things to have happened to Star Trek in quite some time. You'll have people, there are people debating, you know, is this really Star Trek? And, well, yes it is, because I think and to come back to what you were saying there just a moment ago, I don't even think this is so much a matter of what fans went in expecting from this movie, because I think to some degree, while there is obviously inner fan debates around this, I think the key difference is that this almost feels like a film that is pandering to a very select notion of the fans who had come to idolize Gene Roddenberry in Star Trek, and were kind of overlooking the fact that it was a pulp show that just happened to be better than average. And I think in many ways that's kind of why this film, just to sort of delve into its reception at the time, it had mixed reviews, and while it wasn't a bomb, it was not quite the mega hit that Paramount wanted at the time either. So much so that while, yes, there would inevitably be Star Trek II to follow, a tonally a radically different movie, amongst other things about that film, there was a time where that almost ended up being just a TV movie, because the perception was, well, the motion picture wasn't that big of a hit. There might not really be much of a future in the Star Trek thing anyway. So, again, Wrath of Khan would change.
And now, speaking of the film's reception, and especially, like, in relation to Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, now, my understanding, and maybe this is also sort of Hollywood myth-making as well, but Wrath of Khan comes out, and in a lot of ways, it hits the targets that this one fails to, but it seems that in my awareness of, like, the critical response to both films, you know, it's the big critique of this film is not necessarily that it's a bad film, but that a lot of people walked out of it thinking, like, this doesn't feel like a Star Trek film. Whereas with Wrath of Khan, the big takeaway was, well, it's the second film, but it's the first one that really feels like a Star Trek film.
Well, and this is the thing, and it comes back to, I think, when we get into the film proper in just a few moments here, I think there is something to be said to that, but I also think that there is something deliberate about that. And I think it's a bold choice that this film makes that I think for many audiences didn't quite pay, or for many fans, it certainly didn't quite pay off in the way they are. But to me, I think is actually one of the strengths of this movie. Versus, yes, Wrath of Khan, in terms of characterization, I think, in particular, hews much closer to the original series than this film tends to do. At the same time, it's very notable when you watch the motion picture. In many ways, this movie ends up being a dry run for what the next generation would be in its first couple seasons, because, as I said, this is a more self-consciously serious film. By the time you get to the first two seasons of Next Gen, the ones that are heavily overseen by Roddenberry and reflect his ideals the most, that's the point in which Star Trek goes from being somewhat more serious into self-important. And it makes
that's
those
a fine but important distinction.
Yeah, and those first two seasons, when you see what Roddenberry and company do there, that is where, oh my God, if you can make, again, people, make it through the first two seasons of Next Gen, and there is gold to be had starting with season three. But man, especially that first year, it can be borderline insufferable in terms of just how up itself it is in terms of what it thinks of the future and how grand mankind will be and how much better we are than those 20th century fools. Ha ha ha. I apologize.
They might not be wrong. History could still surprise us.
It's entirely true. But I guess, with that said, we should probably explain just what this film is about at this point in time, seeing as how we're 30 minutes in and haven't done that.
Narratively, I think the most striking thing is that a lot of this film is a mystery in terms of what's going on with its narrative. Because basically, our film begins without a whole lot of establishing. Like, we don't get, like, three minutes worth of text crawling, like, bringing everybody up to speed. Instead, we open with a bunch of starships on the edge of space, and all of a sudden they encounter an enormous object that doesn't identify itself and just wipes them out. Next thing you know, Starfleet Command, their monitoring stations start going down, and we basically have this enormous space threat that we know nothing about. And when faced with situations like that, who are you going to call to investigate?
Well, at this point, it would be probably the best of the best in Starfleet, which is, of course, the Starship Enterprise. But as we sort of come to discover, this film doesn't pretend that time hasn't passed since the old show at all. It fully acknowledges that, yeah, it's been about 10 years since we last saw these people in Brand New Adventures.
Yeah, like, it's an in-universe film, but yeah, it very much acknowledges between the end of the show and the beginning of this film, like, the passage of time is crucially important to the narrative here.
Yes, absolutely. So when the film opens up, we get our first shot of James Tiberius Kirk, played by William Shatner himself, but as he's over at Starfleet Command in San Francisco in the 23rd century, but as he gets out, somebody addresses him as Admiral, because, yeah, since the time the show's ended, he's moved up in rank. But as he makes it clear, he tells this young Starfleet officer, be on the ship in 1 hour. It is my intention to be in charge of that ship before it leaves. And what's quickly established is, yeah, Kirk's been promoted, but he is hell-bent on getting back on the Enterprise to oversee this crucial mission to investigate this strange, cloudy object that's destroyed 3 Klingon vessels and is on a direct course towards Earth.
And wouldn't you know it, the Enterprise is the only ship close enough to intercept it before that happens.
Coincidental, but acceptable. But again, as we quickly discover, things are not quite like the ship we left. Certainly, a great deal of the crew is still there. Scotty's there overseeing the overhaul of the Enterprise here, thus explaining why it looks considerably different and, you know, much less cardboardy than the TV show version of it. Uhura's still at the communications console, and Sulu and Chekov are still there running operations and the flight crew. But at the same time, there are two key people missing. One is a little individual called Spock. And where is Spock at this point in time, Andrew?
Well, Spock appears to be back on the Vulcan homeworld, and when we're first introduced to him, he's pretty much undergoing, like, the Vulcan rite of passage, where, as I understand it, and, you know, don't bother correcting me because we gotta get this through this episode, but we meet Spock, and he's pretty much undergoing the ritual that's intended to purge him of all of his human emotion, so he can basically assume, like, his master form version of being Vulcan, where he's basically trying to be Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen, where he is purely a being of rationality and cold logic.
Probably not quite as magical, but yes, generally what is going on. And as we also discover, you know, Dr. McCoy is not on the Enterprise because, as we'll eventually discover, he, based on his appearances, has apparently just decided to chill on Earth at space discos with giant medallions on his chest.
My partner looked over when he walked in. She's like, is that guy supposed to look like he's been drinking all week? Or, no, like, it's DeForest Kelly, hon. It's anybody's guess.
Absolutely. But yeah, yes, they have basically both left Starfleet and aren't around anymore. But who isn't around? Why, that's the captain of the Enterprise. One William Decker, played by, as we've already acknowledged, scumbag Stephen Collins. The one cast member from the sounds of it that Robert Weiss really had any control over casting here. And I will say this up front, putting aside the fact that, you know, comparing Stephen, to call Stephen Collins a piece of human garbage is an insult to garbage. His actual performance in the film, divorced from the man himself, is pretty good. And the
Deckard very much in this film functions almost like a Kirk figure in opposition to Kirk. Because here we have the young, kind of hotshot, incredibly handsome captain of the Enterprise, or at least the status for that is a little up in the air. But we learn that he's been overseeing the Enterprise during all of this upgrading, and for the last 2.5 star years, he has been at the helm. And so all of a sudden, Kirk wants to come in, take his job back. These two are immediately put into tension. And probably because this film goes out of its way to establish that they are very similar. And, I mean, unfortunately, the one trait they have in common is that they don't play well with authority, and they don't follow anybody's rules but their own.
Well, yes and no, but I mean, I think that's maybe a bit more debatable, but certainly, right off the bat, our first what we witness of our grand hero from the original series is him basically coming in and then getting the guy he put in charge demoted, temporarily as it may be, so that he can be in charge of this the Enterprise and get out back on out in the starways. And
there's a certain obliviousness with how Kirk does it as well, because, you know, as Bones points out later, like, the Enterprise isn't just a ship to Kirk. It's an obsession. But in those early scenes, like, where Scotty is taking Kirk out to, like, to visit the Enterprise and look at all the overhaul work, there's that sense of, like, awe and humor in Shatner's face. But, like, that same look extends to him being like, oh, don't worry, I've got it all worked out. And then what becomes, like, one of the running conflicts through the film, though, is the fact that, okay, Kirk, I mean, you can smile and be like, awesome, I get to be the captain again. Just as the audience is probably thrilled. But the rest of the film is sort of like living with the consequences of that decision. And through Decker, we can see that, oh, hey, maybe walking around and calling your own shots and getting everything you want, maybe that occasionally inconveniences other people.
Well, this is the thing. And to come back to sort of the structure and the idea that one of the big criticisms of this film is that the characters don't quite feel like they connect in this movie in the way that they do in the old show. And I think that's, in the case of this movie, while that is one of the things that many people criticize, it's one of my favorite components of this, because
it's true, but it's a very purposeful choice.
Yeah, this is a film about particularly the three key figures of the original Trek, Kirk, Spock, and Bones, reconnecting, particularly Kirk and Spock, and finding their way back to being who they were in the original series. And yeah, it's a film that, for the most part, openly lambasts and shows where these characters tend to downfall. Kirk's ego is very much put on blast in this movie. Spock's efforts to sort of try and suppress that human side of him in totality is very much brought into question when when he encounters what we will come to soon come to discover is a being of pure logic, as he later describes it, a mechanical being. But yeah, so for the majority of this film, about the first half of it is structured around Kirk getting the band more or less back together and then heading out into a mission where it becomes very clear that Kirk is not necessarily at ease at the helm of the Enterprise because it's changed. The people around him have changed, and it's not just as simple as sitting back in the chair and you're A-okay again.
Yeah, and pretty much immediately after going on their mission to save the Earth, things start going wrong in very catastrophic ways. And a lot of that, like, the film doesn't shy away from placing the blame directly on Kirk, because it's almost like, Decker almost says in as many words, like, this is a new ship, you haven't flown anything in the last 3 years. Did you really think that it was going to be as easy as sitting down, snapping your fingers, and everything was going to work out fine?
Absolutely. And I think the real great thing about the way in which the film plays out the tension between Kirk and Decker is that Decker is the more mature individual of these two, because, yeah, he thinks what Kirk does is a terrible thing, and it is. He thinks it's the irresponsible choice, and he's right. But once Kirk's there, that doesn't stop Decker from doing his duty as he's supposed to. He, you know, very quickly, you know, takes up, it's like, fine, I've been technically demoted, but I'm still going to do the best damn job I can doing what I have to. And when I have to call you out on your BS and correct you, I'm going to do it. Not necessarily just to placate my own ego, but because it's the right thing to do. And yeah, no, I mean, this is a film in which, yeah, for that first half, it really does play out as Kirk having the wake-up call that he needs to listen to the people around him. And this is what I really like about this movie is, yeah, it is a character-focused movie, and understandably, you don't get the band back together the way they always were until the final, you know, 15 minutes of the film, but it feels earned in a way that it wouldn't be if it had just, we'd shown up and, oh, hey, in the 10 years, nothing's happened to these people, and they haven't really changed or grown whatsoever.
Well, yeah, and furthermore, I mean, like, I think part of why this film, like, sort of that criticism it opens up of Kirk that, you know, I never remember really being present on the series. Part of the reason why that criticism is sustained is that Deckard makes a really good argument, and it's hard to find fault with it, and moreover, Bones ends up agreeing with him, and Spock to a certain degree agrees with him as well. So even after the more tense standoffs between Kirk and Decker, you know, Kirk sort of sends him on his way, and basically turns to his old friends like, can you believe it? Right? What's up with this guy? And they're basically like, actually, Jim, everything he said is true. You're putting us all in terrible danger.
Absolutely. So yeah, so from a character standpoint, I think this is a film that really works. Now, because of that, because of the choice, really, in some ways, you could sit there and say that the threat of the movie is secondary, and you would not necessarily be wrong there, but again, I think one of the things that Robert Weiss and company really pull off with this film that the original series doesn't, and most of the subsequent Star Trek films and series don't often do, is the fact that what he really sells in this movie is that space is A, the fact that we can even travel through this is kind of awe-inspiring. B, it is the most dangerous place you can possibly imagine because, yeah, when things go wrong, space doesn't care. You will die a cold, horrible death when your technology fails, when things go wrong, when you want to explore things. And
yeah, that was actually the original tagline for the series. but yeah, I mean, this film is, you know, I understand people's criticisms of the pacing of it, and certainly if you are expecting Star Wars A New Hope and you walk into this, you are going to be disappointed because it's not close-ups on, you know, X-Wing fighters zooming through space and things exploding and space fire and all of that. Like, this is a film where, you know, we do get our long and laborious flyovers of the Enterprise, but most of it, the Enterprise is a small object in a vast field of emptiness. And even the threats that they encounter, like certainly inside the villain, which we later learn, the V'ger, you know, there's a sense of weight to the objects around them that the Enterprise is sort of lacking. And so space does feel enormous and like terrifying, but the problem is that imparting that sense of like cold sterility, I mean, we experience that as the audience as well. So, I mean, once the initial shock of, like, space is terrifying and all-consuming wears off, you're kind of left with this feeling of, well, we keep looking outside and it's just the same sort of flat and inert stuff as usual. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, some of the effects work, some of the matte work in particular is stunning, even now in 2018. But I guess I feel like it. They keep going back to the well, and the well only produces that one affectative response. So it becomes less and less effective as the film goes on.
And I can see that. For me, like, I mean, there are shots and sequences of this movie where I agree things maybe go on a bit too long. I mean, the Enterprise flyby with Kirk sort of taking in the ship in awe. I get that, yeah, that thing goes on too long unless you're a super hardcore Star Trek fan. And I can imagine in 1979 seeing this film on the big screen for the first time, and this is the first time the Enterprise is, A, you've seen it in 10 years, and B, oh my God, look what millions of dollars in special effects and models work can actually produce when you have, you know, more than $5,000 and the best effects department Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball's money can buy. But
that in that scene, though, I think Wise and company, they're really counting on the fact that audiences are, you know, mentally aligned with Kirk, where it's like his desire to see the Enterprise and like his need to look at every possible angle. And like, because let's face it, Kirk is in love with the ship to some degree. But I think the film assumes audiences have that same level of intense interest that isn't quite there. And as a result, you know, we end up getting like a 5-minute flyover when you could have had the same effect in one. Like, what sells that scene, it's not the shots of the Enterprise. It's the shots of Kirk's face as he's seeing it again. And like, I think that just speaks to one of the problems of the film, where it's just, we get these grandiose images, we get these, you know, these stunning wide shots of space and just like this unknown emptiness surrounding the ship. But they're pretty things to look at, but we look at it for far too long, and as we're looking at that, our attention is being directed away from the aspects of the film that are most interesting.
And I can agree with that to a certain degree. I am a bit of an apologist for this film in the sense that many of the things in which the film does with its pacing, many of the visual effect sequences we get to see, is stuff that, you know, I just eat up completely. Like, I love the interior of the, what we come to know is it called V'ger. I love the way which goes through. I even love the clearly 2001 inspired sequence of Spock flying into the inner chamber of V'ger, and basically what pretty much is the equivalent of him flying into prog rock album covers of the 1960s and 70s.
And now, when you say inspired by 2001, you mean lifted wholesale from?
It's, okay, it is certainly pretty much Dave Bowman going into the monolith. There is no question.
It's a strong homage.
An extremely strong homage, with the difference being that at least, you know, we get Leonard Nimoy's narration explaining what the hell we're looking at versus, yeah, and not to mention, I would say I love the sequence from 2001. This is not a knock on 2001. But what we mainly see throughout that sequence is an electric light show. Here, there is a bit more variety going through it. And, I mean, again, every single one of the visual images that, you know, Spock is flying by in the case of the sequence is stunning and interesting to look at.
And to be fair, I mean, 2001 as a science fiction film definitely has a different interest than Star Trek, where 2001 sets up a lot of mysteries, but it is not at all interested in resolving them, at least not in the same clear narrative way that audiences are accustomed to. Star Trek is premised on a mystery, but by the end of its narrative, it makes it a point to see that mystery through and solve it.
Well, yes, and I mean, it's the thing. I think 2001, A Space Odyssey, it's a sensory experience above and beyond anything else. I mean, Kubrick, there's a lot of stuff going on in terms of its narrative, in terms of its themes, but I mean, that is a film to be experienced above and beyond anything else. And yeah, Star Trek doesn't quite go, or the motion picture doesn't quite go for that. I mean, it wants to awe you at points, but ultimately, yeah, it wants to bring you back to these characters figuring out what's going on. And yeah, when, for the most part, I would say most of the drama of the latter half of the film, once does work. I mean, certainly as it becomes a... I mean, it certainly goes into classic Star Trek territory. And if we forgot to... we did forget to give our usual spoiler warning at the start of this episode, so apologies to anybody who were spoiling this, you know, nearly 40-year-old movie for.
Yeah, an hour into the episode. I think if anybody who's listened this far realizes that we're spoiling it and they have... minded themselves accordingly.
Yeah, this is true. But I mean, the thing about the rest of the, I mean, this film is, in very much a classic Star Trek fashion, what we've come to discover is that V'ger is some sort of technological being that is, you know, on its way to Earth, as it says, to meet its creator, because it needs to meet its creator for some reason. It's not even entirely sure it knows what that reason is.
And, well, yeah, and there's that wonderful interrogation sequence where, oh yeah, I guess we should also bring up that there is a science officer on board named Ileana, who is then kidnapped by V'ger, and then a robot double is sent onto the Enterprise so they can communicate with this unknown force. But there is that wonderful interrogation sequence where the probe, as they call it, is answering their questions, but in the most circular, like, mechanical reasoning way possible, where it's, what is V'ger? V'ger is that which is created by the creator. And who is the creator? The creator is that which created V'ger. I mean, it's 10 years ahead of, you know, what happens when Brundle mixes with Fly. But in a lot of ways, though, I mean, this film, conceptually, and the idea of V'ger itself, who isn't even named until, like, probably halfway through the film. Like, it's a movie that sets up its mystery well, and I think when we finally learn in the film's, probably, like, in its last half hour, that V'ger, yeah, spoilers from here on out, V'ger is a machine that has gained self-awareness. And we realize that it was one of the old Voyager probes sent off into deep space, got sucked into a black hole. Its mission was data collection and retrieval, and eventually it collected so much data that it became aware of its own existence.
Well, yeah, I mean, we end up discovering that it came across some sort of other mechanized life, which basically, in terms of how they pretty much souped it up and, you know, gave it a consciousness, and then sent it back on its way to complete its mission. But, you know, V'ger, at this point, having gathered all this information up and pretty much having learned as much as there is now heading back to Earth to meet the creator to basically, A, dump that load of information off to whomever. Of course, you know, in the 300-odd years since, you know, it was launched, humanity's kind of forgotten that it was even out there in the first place. And B, once it gets there, part of what it wants to know is, well, okay, what's the next step? What happens? I've done it. Where do I go from here? And that ends up being the sort of defining thematic material of the film, the idea of, you know, self-determination and discovering, you know, well, okay, where do I belong? Where do I, what matters to me? That sort of sense of what is self-fulfillment, per se, which, if that sounds kind of esoteric and philosophical, well, welcome to Star Trek, folks. This is...
Well, what surprised me most about that reveal, though, is the idea of, like, machines having an existential crisis, or the idea of self-awareness in terms of, like, AI and mechanical structures. Like, that is very, very fertile philosophical territory. Like, we see, even now, like, narratives like in Ghost in the Shell and things like that. Certainly Spielberg and Kubrick's AI. You know, this is a theme that contemporary sci-fi still revisits. And I was very surprised to see it as far back as 1979. Because in a lot of ways, like, this film feels very forward-thinking. But I think the central problem is, by deferring the reveal until very late in the game, like pretty much at the climax of the film, the issue is, it's a really interesting concept, and there's a lot of places that they can go with it. But when you have a film that's nearly 2.5 hours long, and you only realize the nature of the antagonist maybe 2 hours, 2 hours, 10 minutes into it, you don't have a lot of time to actually explore that concept. And it builds up the mystery effectively, because we don't know what V'ger is, we don't know, like, its power capabilities or what it's after, but, you know, we're given a satisfying answer to what's behind it without getting any real time to grapple with it, beyond Spock having a couple pithy quotes and us realizing through his words that he's realizing that he can't just be a purely logical being. And eventually, as Kirk realizes, like, the fundamental distinction is that humans are capable of being irrational and using things like the power of belief and emotion and affect. Machines cannot. So humans can always envision that which is beyond them. And V'ger's crisis is its mission is complete. It needs to learn from its creator why it had that mission or what comes next. And on its own, it can't do that.
Yeah, and the thing to me is, it depends. Because the thing to me is, and the fact of the matter is, I've seen this film so many times over the years. Was this your first viewing of it, Andrew?
This was my first viewing of it.
Okay, I think partly why it works for me a bit differently is because watching it every time subsequent or after you recognizing what the mystery is, I think it's very interesting to watch how V'ger behaves in the form of the probe going forward. And I think that sort of gives a little bit of filling in the detail that way. Once we have the recognition of what the mystery is, watching how that performance works out, I think it really does start to flesh out the nature of what V'ger is and its sort of existential crisis. And I think it does end up developing that. It's just, it's one of those things you experience upon the second time through rather than the first time through, necessarily.
But, I mean, for a film where they were literally finishing the effects shots days before its premiere,
yes.
To then all of a sudden be like, well, they were also kind of counting on the fact that people would revisit this. I mean, I'm not terribly satisfied with that. Like, we also take for granted how easy it is to view things repeatedly in 2018. And even though 1979 wasn't a lifetime ago, you know, I appreciate that probably watching it a second time would bring some additional color out of it. But I don't know. It's like in a first viewing situation, though, like the effect is, oh, cool, that's what V'ger is, and up. Oh, credits after roll. That's all, folks.
I can understand that from a, you know, an immediate gut reaction type thing. But I think, yeah, the thing with the motion picture is that time has been kind, as the video revolution has come forward, to making it something that is able to be sat through. And certainly, I mean, I'll put it to you this way. As an introduction to Star Trek, I would probably almost never start with the motion picture as the gateway into it. I think, honestly, the two key points to getting into Star Trek, if you're going to go with the films, are either watching Wrath of Khan, which is pure sci-fi pulp adventure there, or you're watching Star Trek IV The Voyage Home, which is the most accessible and humorous and probably it's the most fun Star Trek film of them all, because it really is just a piece of, hey, let's get to hang out with these characters and, you know, watch them interact in a rather outlandish situation that works. And for those who don't know what The Voyage Home is, you probably will always know it as The One with the Whales. So
I was actually going to guess, is that the whale one?
It's the whale one, yeah.
And I think there's something admirable in the fact that this is a film that chooses to take the risk of resisting like that easy sort of built-in nostalgia slash fan service approach to it. Because as a film, it is trying to do something new with its character dynamics, and especially like the characters in relation to the Enterprise and what the Enterprise means. But the issue is that in order for that to really have its full effect, I think it requires a deeper level of investment in the source material than I had. So, I mean, because for me, at first glance, it's like, okay, here's what's going on. Wait, how come nobody's acting like I remember them to? And I get what the film is doing, but it is off-putting for someone who isn't terribly familiar. Because, I mean, I know that if this film began with 5 minutes of narration saying, the year is X, you know, Starfleet now has a reach of whatever, its mission is, I would probably criticize that for being an exposition dump. But as is, I feel like if you're trying to push it into new directions, that really requires having that moment where you bring everybody up to speed. Because if I knew even less about Star Trek than I currently did, for a film that opens with ships getting blown up and then cutting to Spock on some unknown location, you know, having a non-subtitled discussion of people tapping his forehead, that would probably inspire the same response most people had to the end of 2001. So it's odd. Like, it walks a fine line, and, I mean, I don't think either of us are going to pretend that it doesn't stumble while walking that line.
Certainly not, no. And that's the thing. I mean, this is a flawed movie. You're absolutely right in the sense that this is not... It doesn't really work as an introductory film to Star Trek. Even Wrath of Khan, you know, at the very least gives you that opening title shot of the 23rd century, just to at least establish that, okay, this is the future. If nothing else, that's what you need to know. And yeah, this film doesn't really explain what is Starfleet, what is the, you know, its mission, what are Klingons, even though that one really doesn't matter ultimately at the end of the day. I mean, you know, they're there, and, you know, it's just, okay, they're aliens, they die, doesn't really matter. That was basically fan service.
Yeah, it's okay, because they don't look like we do. Yeah, but I mean, I guess the other thing is, like, the other strategy for trying to do a kind of narrative like this is using new characters as, like, the point of identification. And here's where I still don't know how I feel about it, because taking Decker as a character, him and Ilya are pretty much the only new characters introduced that are of any substance whatsoever. Like, I'm not going to pretend that, you know, some of the different engineering crew has any impact on the narrative.
No.
But Decker does a fair bit of heavy lifting, and Ilya probably, well, decidedly less so, but the issue is they're also in love, we discover. And then it becomes incredibly complicated, and especially knowing what you know about Stephen Collins in real life, the way that his basically, like, a blossoming romance with a robotic duplicate of his former lover is kind of unsettling and strange. But, you know, this is also where the film, like, where its narrative momentum is carried forward through, and ultimately it is Deckard and Ilya that are responsible for bringing the film to closure, right? And the problem is, though, is that, you know, their relationship is never totally established. And again, it doesn't have to be spelled out. Like, they allude to things and that, but we know so little about either character that it doesn't really have any weight to it. And then some of the choices end up being fairly arbitrary. Like, you know, there's a confrontation with V'ger where he, I guess, kidnaps and murders Ilya and then creates a double of her and sends it back. It's not terribly clear to at least this viewer. But then she comes back as a robot, and we're supposed to believe that by the film's end, Decker loves her so much that he's willing to sacrifice himself and merge into a new Omni-being. And yet, it seems when she disappears, and even when she comes back and he learns that, nope, the real one's probably dead. Like, he has no emotional response to that.
And
I'm like, the film can't have you believe both things are true. You can't just roll with someone you love dying and then all of a sudden be totally okay to sacrifice your own life to be with them.
See, the thing about it is, okay, a couple points. Number one, Decker does have a reaction to her death. I mean, certainly, you know, upon her immediate death, you just get that cold response to Kirk of, you know, this is what I define as unwarranted, built upon their earlier conversation.
Okay, all right, I am fighting you on this one, David.
Okay.
Because that is not an emotional response, and I even made a note of it, because earlier, it's a callback to Deckard, standing up to Kirk and basically saying that your desire to lead this ship, that's actually, like, what does he say? It's like, you are exposing us to unforeseen consequences or something along those lines. So after Ilya vanishes off the bridge, Decker gives that line, and I can see a way where it's read, where it comes up as very bitter and very angry. The way that Stephen Collins delivers it, it's like there's a beat, and, like, he just kind of walks in with his arms folded, like, now that's what I call unforeseen consequences.
Yeah.
It feels very tossed off, And, like, it doesn't have the weight of someone who has just seen, like, the love of their life disappear in front of them.
I would disagree. I would say it's a much stronger reaction than you're giving it credit for. But even putting that aside, I mean, the thing about the Ileana robot, I mean, A, she's not quite a robot. Based upon the dialogue that's given, there is elements of her that have been copied and have been roboticized of some sort. But as they acknowledge...
Like, her personality has been... Like, there's... The whole reason why that the plot works is that it is such an identical copy of her that even parts of, like, her brain space and her memories are somewhere latent within this probe.
Exactly.
And, I mean, that's an interesting idea. I think that's one that could be explored in an interesting way. Instead, I think the film just sort of, like, takes that as the base condition. They're like, oh, well, because it is possible, that's where this film is going.
And I will say this. You're not entirely wrong in giving the criticism of how rushed it feels. I think part and parcel, this is probably a remnant of the fact that, yeah, characters like Ileana and Decker, as I understand it, were supposed to be part of the new series.
And that makes a bit more sense in how their story is told here.
Yeah, and it's not a mistake that when you get to The Next Generation, it feels very clear that Decker and her and Ileana are prototype versions of what would eventually go on to become Riker and Deanna Troi from The Next Generation.
And even with my lay knowledge of Star Trek, like, Ilya seemed very, very much like a precursor to some of the ideas they explore with the Borg and the idea of, like, mechanized consciousness.
I was just going to note that there is a Star Trek novel, and if I'm not mistaken, one quote-unquote written by William Shatner himself, that suggests that the Borg evolve from V'ger. To your original point.
No, I mean, like, it's cool, and, like, I feel like it would have played out very differently and probably in a much more nuanced way in a serious version of the same narrative. But, I mean, as is, we have a film where, like, okay, the problem is, even coming into this film pretty blind, I'm like, all right, there are two new characters that are introduced, and they are the only two characters that anything of real consequence happens to, and by the film's conclusion, it finds a way to write these two new characters out of the film. And again, you know, not saying that's a problem in and of itself. But the issue is, like, when the other running plot is sort of Kirk, Spock, and Bones, and them, like, trying to rediscover that kinship between them, trying to address the passage of time, trying to accept the world they live in now. The problem is that Decker and Ilya, I feel like they sort of short-circuit that process. So by the end, we're left with, okay, everyone's back on the bridge, and everyone's kind of friends again. Kirk gets to pilot the Enterprise. But is there really a moment of growth or, like, self-reckoning that Kirk has? Because it feels like the most we get out of that is him and Decker, like, right before V'ger attacks, where they have that moment where it seems like they're going to argue and butt heads, but then they both sort of acknowledge the chain of command and exchange that little nod. And it's a nice moment, but that's not enough for me to believe that Kirk has somehow grown as a person. Because by the end of the film, he gets everything he wanted. He gets everything he set out to do, except this time he doesn't have to screw Decker over it because Decker happily took himself out of the game. So I feel like Kirk just gets everything he wants, and all he really has to do is spend, like, maybe an hour and 20 minutes of his friends kind of being mad at him.
Well, it's, you know what, you're not completely wrong. And I agree with you, and I certainly think when you get to Wrath of Khan, again, you get to see Kirk get that reckoning to a far greater degree as he's forced to confront things like, yeah, I'm getting old now. And yeah, basically, I'm watching people around me die and there's not a damn thing I can do about it. And recognizing that, yeah, no, it doesn't matter how much ego I have, things are going to go south very quickly. I think that, again, well, Nicholas Meyer, when he steps in and Roddenberry is pushed to the side. And again, I keep coming down hard on Roddenberry, but I think, again, much of the stiltedness does end up coming back to him, because Roddenberry is, particularly, like I said, I keep coming back to Next Gen, but it feels like, again, when you see what this film's doing and then ultimately where he takes things in Next Gen, where he had almost total control versus the films, where starting with Part 2, he had input, but in the, I'm just saying, you know, here's my notes, take them and leave them sort of sense.
Oh, thanks, Gene. I'm going to leave them in this box right here.
And that's pretty much what it is. But I mean, you look at what he does and, you know, again, Gene Roddenberry is a person who, by all accounts, when he was presented with an episode about a young boy dealing with grief when his mother dies on an away mission, he was arguing that, no, humans have evolved past grief by the 24th century, and we don't no longer have to deal with it. That's kind of where Gene Roddenberry's head was at, and it's very telling when you watch, you know, how stilted from time to time some of the drama is. And certainly, I think, why a lot of people, you know, once Gene is gone, Next Gen gets better, and, you know, certainly the films, for the most part, are better as, again, I think people like Leonard Nimoy, who would become a very strong guiding hand for the subsequent sequels to this film, ends up, you know, taking it in a far more emotional, cast-driven version of it, and it works better at the end of the day.
I mean, but the problem is, it's not that this film doesn't have emotional drama or it doesn't have character building, because I think, as impressive as some of those exterior shots are, I think really the scenes I'm most interested in are the scenes that explore that divide between the characters. And the problem is, that's where it feels like, for everything it does right, it does something else wrong, and then it just kind of stuck in the middle. Because there's that early scene where Kirk and Bones, they meet again. And, you know, it goes light, and, you know, Bones is basically hesitant to rejoin, and then Kirk has that moment where he says, "Look, Bones, we need you." And then there's that little beat, and basically, "I need you." And, like, It's a nice moment, because that's Kirk, who, you know, fans of the show will know, is basically the infallible space playboy. That's a moment of vulnerability. And when he explicitly says, like, "I can't do this without you," I mean, it's both he can't do it without Bones, because Bones is a great doctor, but he's also his friend. And I think that idea of friendship certainly comes out of the series more as time goes by. But, and also, like, the big difficulty with Spock is that he's become so cold that neither Kirk nor Spock really know how to react around him. And there's that amazing scene of them calling him into, I guess, like, the committee room, and Spock just refuses to sit down. He refuses to banter with them. And eventually, there's that shot of Kirk, like, sitting and, like, pleading and just, like, telling Spock, "Spock, just sit down." And, like, Spock can't. And there's something very vulnerable and something very human in that. And for all we can criticize Shatner's acting, even in this film, like, he does have those little moments where we see that James Kirk is a human being. The problem is, it sets all of this up, but then, thanks to Deckard and Ilya, like, it kind of kneecaps that, where the film doesn't resolve with Kirk having that reckoning. Instead, Spock has a near-death experience by himself, and then wakes up, understands what V'ger is, and then, like, offhandedly is like, "And I saw what it was like to have a life without friendship." And from that moment on, just everyone's back on the same page. And that doesn't feel satisfying.
And
the same way
understand.
That, yeah. You know, Decker and Ilya, we get a lot of hand-wringing over them. But the stakes feel off because we don't really know anything about them and we're not given much time to get invested. The same way that V'ger is about to destroy the Earth and we're reminded at all times, it's the end of everything. And yet in the climax, it's five glowing balls of light hovering in the Earth's upper atmosphere. And, you know, this is a film that constantly tells us that everything that's happening is a big deal and is very important. And certainly as framing tries to present it, but there's this weird disconnect between the stakes as we are told and the stakes as we experience as viewers.
I think part of that, and I mean, maybe one of the reasons I'm a little bit more forgiving of it, is that despite the fact that we have reminders that the Earth is at threat, it's one of those things where I'm pretty sure most audience members would look at this and say, they're not actually going to blow up the Earth. I mean, you know, unless Star Trek has taken a seriously dark turn in the last 10 years, which...
Well, that would be an interesting branching point if they were trying to make, like, a new canonical series out of it. So, I mean, and also, I mean, it's a film version, so of course things are going to be bigger and louder and more important.
It is, but I love the fact that, yeah, I mean, it's in the background there, but it's not really, yeah, the major focus. I like the fact that, yeah, the majority of the film does boil down to what is effectively a bunch of people standing around a giant piece of space junk, looking at it and wondering, oh, hell, how do we deal with this situation? Because we can't blow it up. We can't shoot it. We got to actually find a solution here that isn't, you know, destroy the thing. And I think that's, again, particularly as a Star Trek fan and watching what happens with a wide majority of the sequels that would follow, particularly in the next gen films and in some of the J.J. Abrams movies, where the solution is there's one guy we gotta make sure we blow up and kill. There is something really refreshing about the fact that, yeah, this is the film where, no, it's not about blowing things up. It's about finding a peaceful solution to this problem and working through it and finding that. And to me, that is satisfying in its own way. I mean, certainly, I agree that dramatically, in terms of the character dynamics, it's not as satisfying as it could be. But again, I feel it's maybe partly mitigated by the fact that so much of what would follow afterwards, it gets right. And nothing that this film does destroys anything or gets in the way of getting back to the way things could and should be.
Yeah.
As it were. So, I mean, admittedly, you know, that's, I mean, basically, in some ways, it's damning with faint praise by saying it didn't screw up things too badly, which I admit is
not sometimes that is the best you can hope for. But, I mean, I agree with you that I think the dynamic is interesting because you're right. V'ger isn't, it's not a threat that can be controlled or conquered. And I think there is something very refreshing about a film where it's like, well, this thing, we don't understand it. It is more powerful than we can possibly comprehend. It's basically God. So we just need to figure out how to accommodate it. And sort of emphasizing like that exploration and understanding of the unknown instead of just hitting it with whatever heavy ordnance you have lying around. Like, I think that's neat, and I think that's something, in the case of this film, it works a lot better than some of the moralistic storytelling by the time you get to the Abrams films. Like, Star Trek Into Darkness is a film that ends with a eulogy about how we aren't going to be motivated to, like, strike down our enemies. All the while, the day was saved by cryogenically freezing your enemy and stealing his magic blood.
Yeah. But,
you know, the problem I think for me is that simply looking at this film as a film unto itself, it's like, if you bracket off the paratext, as hard as it is to do, the issue is that most of the consequential dynamics are character-based in the first half of the film, and like even the first three quarters of the film. But by the time we get to the climax, it feels like the film is almost positing, like, no, it was the fact that the Earth was in danger from this scary alien. That's really what we've been here and interested by all along. And I don't think that's the case.
No, and I would agree with that. It doesn't strike me as if it's particularly interested or trying to convince people that it's the big threat. It feels more like this was to appease the studio at this point, where it's like, you need something there to suggest. It's like, okay, what's the cheapest, easiest thing? The Earth's in danger. Boom, there we go. And I mean, I think, again, it's very telling that when you come back to that Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, the one with the whales, the setup in some ways is fairly similar, where, yeah, a probe comes to Earth and its sheer presence is putting things in danger. The difference being that, yeah, that film doesn't really emphasize, the probe just gets things started. It's not necessarily the mystery in and of itself, because they figure out what it wants very early. The rest of the film is basically, how do we achieve that in the most delightfully comic fashion possible. So
I hope it wants whales and 1930s gangsters.
Well, you get one of them.
Well, one out of two ain't bad. Yeah. It's just, I mean, Okay. I mean, for those of you who follow me on Twitter know that I had a particularly salty hot take about this film. And again, it is kind of frustrating because so much of this film feels like not only are we looking at characters as they just respond to events, but especially because, you know, the fact that they're in deep space means that we're not just watching them respond. We're watching them watch things on TV. And, like, it's this sort of doubled abstraction where it feels like even less is happening than actually is. But it doesn't have to necessarily be completely impactful in the sense of, like, a nonstop, thrill-a-minute joyride through the cosmos. But I feel like it doesn't adhere to the narrative beats that it sets out for itself. And I find that very odd and very curious, because there are a lot of narrative elements that work very well. And there are a lot of narrative elements that are alluded to and are very interesting, though unexplored. But it seems like, especially by the climax, like as wonderfully shot as that whole closing sequence is, you definitely feel a tension between not just the studio and the cast and crew making this film, but even through the different writers and through the different creative hands on this film. You can definitely see that there is this constant tension between what is a Star Trek movie supposed to be.
No, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, it's not mistaken. Again, you know, watch this film, watch Wrath of Khan, and then watch the pilot for Next Gen. And it's very easy to see where the branching happens and who brought what to the table. Because, yeah, I mean, there's the unmistakably Roddenberry aspects, and then there's the people who, you know, there's the stuff in Wrath of Khan that Roddenberry was not fond of, but, you know, in many ways does improve things. Like, I love we haven't even talked about the production design of this movie for the most part, but this is a gorgeous-looking movie, but one of the big sticking points has always been the costumes that the cast wears in this film. I personally like the uniforms that are presented here, but there's no mistaking that, you know, the naval uniforms, for lack of a better term, in 2 through 6 have become equally as iconic as the original series, you know, gold, blue, and red uniforms are there. And, you know, Roddenberry hated those. He hated anything that suggested Starfleet was militaristic, which I think is one of those things where you get the sense that he doesn't really understand his own creation, because what is Starfleet if it isn't military, to a greater or lesser extent? I mean, yes, they're explorers in space. They still have a rank system. There is still weapons on board your ships for when you need them. So I don't get it.
Yeah, it's just, I think the problem is that, like, that is also one of those early indicators that this movie is going to be something other than a sizzle reel for the series that preceded it. And I think that it's also kind of telling, though, that instead of, like, just sort of that, even the sort of popping colors of the TV series, like, here everything is very modernistic, everything is very sleek and chrome and shiny, but everything kind of gets reduced to, like, the same level of visual flatness. And that's discounting completely all the exteriors, because, yes, they are dynamic and they are beautiful to look at. But in terms of the costuming and the set of the Enterprise itself, like, it feels very colorless. And I get that this film is trying to maintain, like, a tone of sterility, or that with time's passage, like, we've lost some of the warmth and the chemistry between the cast. But, like, again, I can appreciate that that's what the film is doing on some level. But as a viewer, it's also less interesting to just watch, like, a monochrome palette for 2.5 hours.
It depends. Like, for me, for my tastes, I think this film is visually quite a stunner, and I think that the compositions Robert K. Weiss uses throughout it in terms of using the widescreen frame are simply marvelous, for the most part, and certainly beat some of what we would see in some of the later entries in the series. I'm looking at you, Insurrection and Nemesis, but I mean,
some of the effects work would actually beat even current-day sci-fi in a lot of regards. Like, it does hold up.
Oh, yeah.
And for a film that, yeah, again, apparently was being finished, like, the week it was premiering, like, that's no mean feat. Like, you can't see the seams here. And, I mean, aside from some really bad backdropping when Spock does his 2001 reference, aside from that, like, this is a film that still looks remarkably good and remarkably well integrated from frame one to frame Omega.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, and the plus side, at least unlike, say, The Next Generation, the Enterprise Bridge doesn't look like a beige living room, so... So,
for the man who has everything.
Precisely.
But yeah, like, this really is a film where I can appreciate a lot of its efforts while at the same time not necessarily appreciating the outcomes of that. And I mean, I think this conversation has been very interesting because you and I sort of come to this film with very different degrees of, like, background exposure, even, you know, number of times we've seen this film. And I think in talking to you about it, I can understand, appreciate a little bit more. And perhaps you are right, where the more I revisit this, you know, I can probably gain more of an appreciation of. The problem is just after that initial viewing, I'm not 100% sure that I want to revisit this and learn to appreciate it more.
That's fair. And I mean, it's the thing. Like, I don't think this really is a film for, I'm going to say, it's Star Trek fans. Whether they like the film or not, the thing about it is it really, as a key piece of the franchise's development, it's essential watching, I find. Like, it can't be overlooked. And I think because it isn't designed necessarily in a way that, you know, or in a way that invites new people in quite the same way that, say, again, Wrath of Khan or Voyage Home, or even to, some of the, or the J.J. Abrams films to that degree. It's not welcoming of new people in quite the same way. It's going to have a limited audience. It's a film that you should almost watch in retrospect or once you have a wider framework to come to it as, because yeah, it doesn't necessarily work as a standalone film in quite the same way. And I think that's always one of those, you know, the tricks that's very difficult for feature films adapting television to deal with. Because certainly, on the best end of the spectrum, you can get something that does stand on its own while still developing what people loved about the initial program. On the other hand, sometimes you get the X-Files I Want to Believe, a film that satisfies nobody and is absolutely nothing more than an extended terrible episode of the show that nobody knows or cares to want to watch, unless your name's James, but you know, that's neither here nor there. So it certainly is. And I think there's one film I'm very film I'm very intrigued to come to because it of its placement in context in terms of how it's adapting a show and then placing it, you know, sort of almost as a comparison with this film, because I think we'll come to some interesting conclusions, or at least perceptions on it when it comes time for that, but...
Well, and I think if nothing else, it's very illustrative that for all we tend to think of Star Trek being this homogenous audience and Star Trek being this homogenous aesthetic, you know, and certainly in 2018, it means something a bit different, I think, when we talk about Star Trek. The idea of through all of its ancillary series and all of these sort of Elseworlds narratives that have stemmed from it, I mean, Star Trek definitely has much more of a sense of, like, I think a core iconography in the present than it would have at the time this film came out. But I think it is interesting to go back and realize that its success on screen was by no means assured, and even certainly the fans and even the people making it, like, this is a moment where everybody is sort of competing to win that argument of, no, this is what our show is actually going to be. This is how we're going to define ourselves. And even up until the moment of its release, it seems like that argument never quite got resolved. And so I think there is something interesting that you do have, as you say, sort of outlier titles like this, where different fans will have different responses to, but I think that ultimately ends up being a testament to the fact that no matter how you want to typify any long-running series or franchise, there's probably going to be a little bit more diversity under the hood than you might give it credit for.
No, absolutely. And with that wonderful summary of it there, I think it's a great capstone to our discussion. I guess we should turn our attention to the hits and pits of this film. So, Andrew, as the one who was subjected to this by me, I feel it's, you know, important to offer you the opportunity to first offer a hit on your part.
Okay. Well, I mean, this one, I had a feeling it was going to be my hit when I pressed play, and I was just as happy to realize it was when I pressed stop, and that is DeForest Kelly as yes. Hank McCoy.
Hank McCoy?
Isn't it? Well,
Hank McCoy is the Beast. Yes.
Okay, well, what's Bone's first name then?
Leonard McCoy.
Leonard? Okay.
Yes.
Anywho, that's what I get for, you know, being being too accustomed to different nerdy properties. So, as Leonard McCoy, DeForest Kelly, he has the perfect, like, I'm too old for this resignation in everything that he does. But, I mean, it's a joy on the series. But here, he's allowed to be much more than, like, the malcontent. And, in fact, like, in a lot, especially through the first half of the film, he's sort of the conscience of the film. Because he has those sort of the bigger moments where him and Kirk, like, butt heads, especially after the one scene with Decker. And he basically questions Kirk's authority. Kirk tells him off, and he says, all right, is there anything further? And Bones, like, without even blinking, just shoots him a look, and he says, well, I guess that depends on you, and walks out of the room. And, like, even when they're about to go into warp, and, you know, Kirk's finally back at the helm, and he's excited and, like, issuing orders, like, Bones doesn't call him out on it. He doesn't, like, make a big production. He just, like, walks up and almost whispers in his ear. And he's like, Jim, your people know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Don't force them. And, like, Kirk basically is just like, well, what are you talking about? And sure enough, immediately, everything goes wrong and everyone's about to die. But, like, I don't know. There's something just, I feel like Bones is sort of the human heart of this film, where he gets to have those moments of just, like, spite and bitterness, but by the film's conclusion, he's also kind of back to his old self. And, I mean, there's that great exchange where after Spot kind of realizes the nature of V'ger and is like, I suggest, like, you know, we think of this thing as a god, but I suggest you talk to it more like a child. Yeah. And then Kirk basically has his negotiation, and then V'ger starts rallying the ship, and then Bones just throws that, like, that perfect Bones look up and goes, huh, well, looks like God's having a temper tantrum.
That's
and, like, I mean, I really enjoy Carl Urban's approach to Bones. I think he's probably the highlight of the Abrams reboot. But at the same time, once you see DeForest Kelly playing the role, you realize that it's a great character, but there's only one man born to play him, and it was so good seeing him on screen.
DeForest Kelly is hands down the best actor. I won't say he's the best actor to have ever Trek, but he is hands down, gives my favorite performance as my favorite character in the entire series. And, I mean, I love the fact that, yeah, Carl Urban, when you look at his performance, his approach is basically, I can't top this, I might as well just be imitating him. And it works, and for the most part, without being, you know, the things where he's just doing nothing more than an impersonation, per se. That sounds contradictory, and it is, but I digress nonetheless. The point of the matter is, but yeah, you're absolutely right, DeForest Kelly is just astonishing, and he is a pure delight in every single one of these films. Even when he gets, like, the least amount of stuff to do, you know, if he wasn't there and it was just the Shatner Nimoy show, it would not work nearly as well with him being gone.
You need the three, just as the DC Universe needs their trinity, so does Star Trek.
Absolutely.
But what about you, Dave?
One thing that I definitely want to praise that we haven't mentioned whatsoever here, although it almost will go without saying once it is, Jerry Goldsmith's score to this film, because there is a reason that Star Trek is one of these franchises that has had a ton of great music built around from many different composers. You have Alexander Courage's original theme, which is sort of the basis for pretty much any theme that's been done yet, at least the opening section, the classic dun 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 dun. Yeah, that whole, I'm doing a terrible job of it, but you get my drift.
Well, I still loved hearing it.
Yes. But again, when John Williams, or not John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, his score here, though, there's a reason this has become sort of, for many people, like, A, the de facto Star Trek theme. I mean, certainly it was used on The Next Generation as their opening theme with good reason. It's that good. But
oh,
it's
really?
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. I mean, for so long, I'd watched Next Gen, that it's like, oh, okay, this is the Next Generation theme, that when I kind of watched, or one of the first time I watched the motion picture, and this theme kicked in, it's like, wait, what? This preceded it? I was stunned, because, like, that, I mean, this is the only film used it. It's like, yeah, this is amazing, and it's this beautiful orchestral theme that is just as iconic to what Star Trek is, and really set the tone for what I think most people think of what the sound of Star Trek is, and with good reason. And the blending, as we sort of acknowledged when we talked about the Logan's Run episode, his use of large orchestras plus these sort of eerie electronic sounds. Again, I think he refines it to perfection in this movie. I love the sound that he associates with V'ger, the way in which it's this very ominous threat with these, you know, sort of electronic bursts brought into it. It really gives this creepy vibe to it. And honestly, again, that's not to knock, you know, Leonard Rosman or James Horner or anybody else who's gone on to write music for these films, but certainly, you know, Goldsmith was score is perfect here, and this is long before he kind of got into the rut with the Next Gen movies, where it just became, and here's, we're just going to trot out the same old themes again and again and again.
Yeah. Riker's on. Love theme. It's a leitmotif. I would disagree with you a little bit. I think maybe, okay, this may be completely unfair as well, but yeah, like, I looked at the score very much through the lens of Logan's Run, which we previously looked at for the show, and we did really enjoy the score for because of that really odd diversity that Goldsmith brought to it. And I guess I feel, and I mean, understanding that this is the theme that carried over to The Next Generation is interesting. It explains a bit more. My initial reaction, though, was this film's score struck me as very imitative of what Kubrick was doing with 2001, and not necessarily in a way that benefits the film. Like, the sort of inflated sense of grandiosity. And I mean, talking through the film with you, I feel like I'm willing to give it a little bit more credit. Because on the first viewing, though, it's like, well, it's masterful. It sounds like there's, like, a proper orchestra behind it. And yet, it's just sort of there. It's like the Enterprise itself, where it's like, it's a jazzed-up version of something familiar. And it's shinier, it's brighter, it's more expensive, it's suited for the big screen, but it's lacking a certain weight to it. But, I mean, to be fair, like, you know, there's a reason that this score has gone on to be iconic and recur throughout the franchise. So, I mean, clearly you're not the only one who thought that Goldsmith was doing some good work here. And I guess to fault him for not being quite as experimental as he did 5 years previously, that's not necessarily to say it's bad. It is more than serviceable. And at least, if nothing else, it's very suitable to the images that it underpins.
We will return to the Jerry Goldsmith debate on the day in which we get to Total Recall and discuss the score to that movie, which is also awesome. But
all right.
Until then, Andrew, what is your next hit?
My next hit? That's a tough one, because we always try and think of the things that we haven't celebrated before. But I guess this is tough. Because I really don't want to give it to Stephen Collins. And I think there are objective reasons that keep his performance from being a really good one. I'm going to actually take a somewhat bold stance and say that I enjoy William Shatner's performance here. And we all know that, you know, William Shatner supposedly is the worst actor in the world, can't act his way out of a paper bag. And I feel like here, though, he is Kirk and he is not Kirk. in the sense that there is that difference from how he's presented on the series, and there is that different thematic richness, and we get to see an older, more vulnerable Kirk that suddenly can't rely on the things that he takes for granted. And, I mean, it's not in the big moments where he's capital A acting. It's the little details, like his little plea with Bones and his little plea with Spock. And, you know, just those gestures, that look of joy on his face seeing the Enterprise, or in spite of this mega, like, Omega-level cataclysm about to approach Earth, there is that little glimmer in his eye because he knows it means that he gets to step up to the helm again. And, you know, I think this is a good performance to show people when they think that Shatner is all like this. And, I mean, it's weird because I feel like Stephen Collins is, in trying to share the screen with Shatner, is trying to emulate a very Shatner style of performing. But there's something that's just suited to how Shatner does it that Collins can't duplicate. And I don't know, like, I feel like this is a performance that only works because it's William Shatner doing it in this film. But I really liked how he portrays Kirk here, and I didn't think that that would be one of my takeaways. So, Montreal's own, kudos to ya.
It's the thing, Shatner is, I agree, I like his performance here, and I think the key with Shatner is, it all depends upon who's directing him. I think Robert Wise is a, you know, old school veteran enough that he knows how to control Shatner, and I think, well, when you get to the Nicholas Meyer directed films, Meyer has actually given the anecdote about how to direct Shatner that I think is really telling, which is basically you never use the first take with Shatner. You keep having him do take after take after take because his instinct is to play it big and broad the first time, and gradually his energy lowers to the point where suddenly it starts feeling more real and, you know, less grandiose necessarily, and it ends up working better. And yeah, I think,
and like the final shot in this film, just that little hand wave of, no, just go ahead. It's like in that little gesture, it's funny, it's human, and that more than anything conveys, even though the film sort of lets his performance down in the sense of showing that change in Kirk's personality, that final, like, you know, laissez-faire approach to where they're going next, I think that encapsulates a lot of the themes of the film, and it works solely through Shatner's delivery of it. Like, that in itself is able to step in and carry the weight where so much of the script seems to have fallen apart.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So I guess this brings me to my final hit, and I want to actually give some of the dialogue credit, because there are plenty of places where the script falls down flat. I mean, certainly anytime we get Shatner's delivering the line about how many hours away from this entity hitting Earth. I mean, because he says it like about 5 or 6 times throughout this entire movie. And it's almost always like, Bones, we are only 6 hours away from this thing getting here. We need answers. And it just keeps happening and happening and happening. That stuff is terrible. But there are choice lines that are either humorous or, you know, warming, you know, such as, you know, the, as you've already acknowledged, the that-away line is great. Ilya's initial scene where she notes that her dedication to celibacy is on the record is a purely delightful screw you to both Decker and Kirk. And, you know, definitely plays off of the iconic idea of Kirk as a giant womanizer in his history of that. And yeah, every single line DeForest Kelly is pretty much given in this movie is gold, without question. I mean, I would probably say that the only one who, I mean, obviously, you know, certain actors are not serviced well. I think George Takei gets next to nothing to do, say, that's memorable.
And he gets, like, next to no dialogue here.
Exactly. Same with Nichelle Nichols and Walter Koenig. None of them are given really much to do, and the subsequent films would really improve upon that as they went forward, particularly once Nimoy directs 3 and 4, and he really, really starts giving the rest of the cast something to do. But yeah, I mean, it really is, you know, I think there is some choice dialogue in the film that's worth remembering. So there's my last hit there. But I guess...
All right, and with our last hit, it's time to rearrange the letters. Or, for a more PG audience, let's just throw in a P and come up with our pits.
Yes.
These are the little gripes and grumbles that we didn't get to in our discussion proper. And, there being a lot we didn't get to, I can imagine we can come up with a few here. So, this is a scene, and it's a scene that I think really displays this film's worst tendencies, the warp scene.
Okay.
Because, basically, the Enterprise ends up going into warp, and what follows is, it's not just things going wrong, it's about a 4 to 5 minute sequence of everybody moving in slight motion blur with some interesting lighting effects, but the problem is, this scene goes on for so long, and the entire time, all the dialogue is slow motion. And the issue is that it becomes very difficult to take seriously when it's like, oh wait, you know, the reactor core is about to explode. You know, it's hard to take that seriously when what it actually comes out as is Stephen Collins, like, diving slowly across the Enterprise deck and saying, "Don't fire the torpedo." And it's that. Just, it's a scene where it's a big effect sequence that, I mean, it's impressive on first glance. It goes on much longer than it should for no real necessary reason. And in doing so, it kind of exposes how ridiculous all the proceedings are. Like, I know it's probably not the objective worst thing in the movie, but that was definitely the moment where I'm sort of like, am I really going to like this film by the end of it? It's, I don't know. I mean, I get it. If you're doing something on the big screen, especially an established property, you want to take advantage of the higher budget and the different tech and the fact you can take your time on things. But it feels like this is a sequence where it's too long by twice as much as it needs to be, and also they can trot out, hey, look at this cool effects work that we put together, and I think the film suffers for it.
I enjoy the scene more than you do, but yeah, I could see easily how...
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, but I could easily see how it would get on somebody's nerves really quickly. I think part of what helps... the scene, or my enjoyment of the scene, though, is that it does lead to the conference between Decker, Bones, and Kirk in Kirk's ready room, which A, is an extremely well-written scene, and then climaxes what I think is one of the best shots in the film, which is Bones exiting the room and just seeing the doors slide shut with that sort of tinted, almost sunscreen to it, look to it, and Kirk mm-hmm. just standing in isolation. I think that's a really great shot in the film. So I'm a little bit more forgiving
for sitting through. It's worth sitting through a bad sequence if it takes us to a great one. So yeah.
But no, I can understand that being a pit. Personally, a fairly. I'm trying to think about how to phrase this, but in terms of oh boy. You know, I had the thought in my head there, and now it's completely going on me.
Is it the fact that nobody points out that Spock directly caused Ilya's death?
No, because the whole... Okay, I would debate you with that one, because, again, he does what's necessary. This thing's...
We don't know if it's necessary. The film never tells us what's even happening.
He tells us exactly...
Cool with this electricity storm on the bridge.
No.
They let it scan the computer, and then they're like, oh, it's going through the computer. And
yeah.
Then Spock smashes the keyboard, and yeah. Then it kills Ilya.
Yeah, it's going through their entire systems of wear. You have how much stuff that's likely secret on that ship? Of course you don't want it accessing that stuff. So yes, he smashes the keyboard, which... To be fair, in 2018, does seem a little bit ridiculous as, once again, much like in the case of Spawn, the film, we know that the actual information isn't being stored there, but I'm willing to cut them a bit more slack in 1979 that, okay, if we smash this one terminal, it can't access it anywhere else. So, huzzah. And this, yeah, it does trigger to V'ger seemingly taking the approach of, what are these annoying things getting in my way? Let's take one and find out. So I will defend that component of the film.
But there's no rhyme or reason why it takes Ilya. You know, it works out beautifully for narrative convenience. But the whole time, like, this is a scene where we see things and we don't understand anything that's going on.
I and perfectly understood what was going on, but I grant you, convenience. Yes, there's no question of convenience.
Also, people are selectively vulnerable to space electrocution. Just pointing out.
In the grand scheme of things, it's hardly the worst fault of this movie. Having said that, to actually come to a real pit for this...
Oh, a real criticism.
Yes.
Plan worked. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes. While I said that this is a film that's more self-consciously serious compared to the original series, but it doesn't quite step into self-importance, there is one moment where I question that, and that is the absolute final shot before we go into the credits. The human adventure has only begun.
Yes. Oh, God, yes. I can't believe I almost forgot that.
It is... I get what you're going for. I believe you all meant well, but give me a friggin' break. That does not really belong there.
Well, yeah, because immediately preceding, we're watching a sex offender fall in love with a robot, and then we're told the human adventure has just begun. It's like, maybe it should stop right now, please.
To be fair, in 1979, Robert Weiss probably didn't know that Stephen Collins was a sex offender. I don't think many people knew that at that time. But certainly, one way or the other, yeah, I guess looking at it in 2018, it does add to the awkwardness of the end of this film.
Yeah, and that's not a failure of the film itself. But again, even so, just to end any film with... Yeah. The human adventure has just begun. It's like, well, somebody who was involved in the making of this film thinks it's a good, it's a very important artistic statement.
Yeah, Gene. But yes. Yes, that's my first pit here. Andrew, I'm willing to bet you have a second one.
They're all just nitpicks. I think I also got like the next three episodes worth just now, so I'm willing to reserve commentary. Dave, do you have any other major flaws?
Not really. Like, much like you said, I think most of what's there is nitpicky. I would certainly say, yeah, giving the bulk of the supporting cast from the old show nothing to do. It's not unexpected. I mean, even the old show barely gave most of those actors something to do most of the time. Although at least James Doohan here gets one good scene. So, Sarnia's own, James Doohan.
Yeah. It's a character-driven film, but it's not... That's not to say it's an ensemble piece.
No, certainly not. And I think that's, you know, the key difference when you get to... And I think it was something that ends up making the next-gen films... they suffer from to a greater degree, where that was a legitimately an ensemble show, and the movies most certainly are not. But yeah. So I guess with that pretty much brings our time with... Star Trek the Motion Picture to a halt. Stay tuned for the day when we get to Insurrection and we truly get to fall asleep at the wheel. But till that time, Andrew, I guess I'm now relinquishing the wheel over to you. Where are you taking us next?
Why, thanks, Decker. I think, you know, it was, when you first suggested this, I was excited, but I'm like, can we go anywhere other than a Star Trek movie or a bad Shatner film? And it turns out, without too much difficulty, I found a way. Instead, we are going to set our chronometers to the year 1978, and we're going to be heading to San Francisco, where we follow old friend of the show Donald Sutherland and friend from this episode Leonard Nimoy into Philip Kaufman's remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. A 20-year removed remake of the original story that may or may not be all about another friend of our show, McCarthyism and the Red Scare. And, carrying on the idea of adaptations across different forms and odd unknown threats from outer space, it'll be an interesting film to revisit, and especially with you as my co-pilot.
Absolutely. So, yeah, tune in for that a week from now. But let's just say, Andrew, that angry Trekkers, or Trekkies, as they prefer to be known, want to come and attack us. Where can they do that?
Well, you can find me full of resolve and absolutely without fear over on Twitter at FilmsTripper. And you, Dave?
You'll find me absolutely not caring at 24 Panels on Twitter. And Andrew, where can they rate and review the show if they so choose?
Well, I'm glad you asked. 5-star reviews are usually the best way to get some attention on us and move us up in the listings, especially on iTunes or whatever podcatching service you use. Not only do they help us build a bit more of an audience, which is slowly ticking up week by week, thanks to you lovely people at home, but your feedback is what helps drive the show. If we're doing something you love, let us know and we'll do it. And if we're doing something you hate, let us know and we'll try really hard not to do it. At the end of the day, we just want to make the kind of show that you want to listen to, and without your feedback, it's a lot harder for us to do that.
Absolutely. So, with that said, Andrew, are there any parting words you would like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, there are. The human adventure has... Oh, wait, yes. remember, everybody, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Or you're just touring around a spaceship. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes, I understand. Bye.